David Crow.
Thank you for tuning in to episode 206 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm. Subscribe to a podcast or listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990. New for 2019, PRN.fm has voicemail. Call 862-800-6805. And as well as leaving a message or question for the show, leave your name and indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth. Again, remember that long-distance charges may apply. Remember, I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, very important, I'll send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor the show, you can email money via PayPal to david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or make a monthly donation at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. And now let's get to this week's interview. Cynthia P. Garrett is an attorney in California. She earned her Juris Doctor at the University of San Diego School of Law, where she was a published member of the Law Review and graduated magna cum laude. Her undergraduate degree is from Rollins College in Florida, where she graduated with highest distinction. She worked as a social worker for 3 years before entering law school and practiced civil litigation in San Diego for 10, including with Baker & McKenzie, from which she retired to raise two daughters and a son. She's since worked part-time as an attorney, served on the boards of nonprofits focused on foster children, and has drafted opinions for the California Court of Appeal. Since 2014, Cynthia has been involved with Families Advocating for Campus Equality, FACE, and now serves as its co-president. As a representative of FACE, Garrett has written articles and position papers, lobbied for fair campus disciplinary procedures on both the state and federal levels, met with Department of Education officials, including Secretary Betsy DeVos and Candace Jackson, served on an American Bar Association task force, which developed recommended Title IX procedures, has been interviewed in many places, NPR, PBS, Fox, ABC, MSNBC, WNYC, etc., and has been quoted in various articles and serves as a liaison for two sexual misconduct projects within the American Law Institute. I'm particularly interested in her involvement with FACE and the issue of due process for people accused of campus sexual misconduct. Welcome to the show, Cynthia.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I'd just like to ask you first whether you became interested in the issue of campus sexual assault because of a personal circumstance, perhaps a young man that you knew who was accused or something like that, or did you get involved just because you were asked to be a legal expert?
I did know someone that was going through the process, and my reaction as a lawyer was, no, that can't be right. And you can't do that in America. So I started researching, and it turned out they were right, and that was what was happening, and that's what got me inspired. You know, coincidentally, at the same time, my kids were all off to college or grad school, so it seemed like a perfect time for me to pick up on this issue.
You don't seem like the kind of person who wants to sit around the house doing nothing.
How do you get that from the little bit you've spoken to me? That is so true. Oh my God, that is so true.
As a woman, did you have any concerns? You're mostly defending boys, maybe not defending in a strict legal sense, but speaking up for boys or men who are the ones accused versus mostly women who are doing the accusing. So did you have any concerns about doing that as a woman?
I've always had a very strong sense of fairness and justice. Maybe that's partly why I became a lawyer. And I don't think I even gave it much thought, the fact that I was a woman. I think all I thought was, I need to fix this. I need to get out there and let people know what's happening. This is incredibly unfair.
What exactly is unfair? Is it just the due process issues, which we'll definitely get into in detail, or are there other aspects of the situation on campus that you think are unfair?
A lot of the factors came together to create the unfairness. Part of it is due process, but technically that's only owed to public entities or institutions. Just basic, fundamental fairness was, the lack of it was shocking to me. And I and you have to understand, and you probably know, that a lot of this is the result of the Obama administration issuing guidance that focused more on victims of sexual assault than it did on those that were accused. And unfortunately, not every accuser is a victim. And it takes proper procedures to determine whether they're a victim. But in the rush to protect actual victims, which is commendable, the rights and the rights of the accused were thrown aside. And in fact, the guidance documents even said not to let the due process rights or protections of the accused interfere with the rights of the complainant. And with the threat of taking away federal funding, schools really took that to heart, though it turned out later, because the process didn't go through notice and comment rulemaking, that they really couldn't have taken away federal funding. But that's where it started. Well, it didn't actually start there. It started even before that with this whole movement, an ideological movement that focused on America as a patriarchy and men having the power in sexual relationships, and somehow morphed into this idea that women are all potential victims and men potential rapists, which I obviously don't agree.
I kind of felt that the whole Obama administration initiative on campus sexual assault was kind of based on the assumption that sexual assault was a bigger problem on campus than in other areas. I think it's probably a bigger problem where you get a lot of young people together who are sexually inexperienced and high hormone levels, etc. But is it worse on campus than, say, on work sites where there's a lot of young people, or the military, or places like that? Do we have that evidence?
There could be other studies. The only one of which I'm aware is, I think it was 2015, Bureau of Justice Statistics found that students or women of comparable age to students off campus were at higher risk, which makes sense to me because they're, you know, they have environments that aren't as supportive or positive often. If you're not going to college, it's often because you can't afford it, and so they're more disenfranchised, and that makes sense. And whether or not there was a true epidemic on campuses, I don't really know. I try not to argue statistics because it's a losing battle. You know, if you can make your studies say whatever you want your studies to say, and in fact, a lot of the studies on which they relied used questions like, did you ever have sex while intoxicated? And even if there was a question that said, were you ever sexually assaulted? And the subject said no, if they also answered yes to, did you ever have sex while intoxicated, they were still classified as a victim, even though the subject specifically said they weren't a victim.
To me, the whole intoxication thing, like I agree that at a certain point, a woman or a man is completely incapable of consent. And there have been cases where, I don't know of any men being victims in this way, but there have been cases where women who are unconscious or unable to stand have, you know, been, I think, clearly sexually assaulted. But at the other end of the spectrum, a woman may have one drink in a night and may be less intoxicated than the man. Like, there seems like a big gray area with alcohol between, I had a drink, I'm really not you know, not really affected that much versus, you know, I can't stand up, I'm unconscious because of the alcohol?
Well, first of all, there are cases where the man has been more intoxicated than the woman and, in fact, passed out. But I agree with you. Of course, if somebody is incapacitated, and they should be using that term, I believe, that's a whole different issue. I mean, that is an assault. And, you know, as a woman, that would be obviously criminal, in my opinion. But the schools, some of the schools even say one drink negates your consent. And these are people that aren't consenting. These are also people who often pregame by going to another place before a party and take shots so that they're loosened up before they get to the party. Right. I learned this from one of my daughters. And so they are specifically getting intoxicated to loosen themselves up, probably anticipating even having sex. Who knows, right?
Right.
And yet then they can turn around and use it as an excuse for why they shouldn't be held responsible for their own actions.
Right.
And that's just...
It seems to create an absurdity where, let's say that a man had a couple of drinks and the woman had none and they had sex. If we take this strict rule that, you know, one drink waives consent, then the woman just sexually assaulted the man.
There's a couple of issues with that. First of all, generally, men aren't likely to file complaints. They just aren't, because they blow it off, which is what I used to do, you know, what I did as a woman in college. I would just say, okay, well, that was a stupid decision. Let's move on. But now they revel in it, and, you know, they build it up in their minds, and all of a sudden it becomes this horrible thing. But the second part of that is that even if they did file complaints, schools very rarely took them seriously. And, you know, there's the option of filing a complaint with the Office of Civil Rights for the Department of Education, and many men did that. Not as many men as women, but there were many men that did that because they felt they'd been treated unfairly. Under the previous administration, there was only one case in which the Office for Civil Rights ruled in favor of an accused student out of thousands. I mean, it was as though nobody really wanted to acknowledge that that was possible. So it was definitely imbalanced in the treatment of men who also may have been accused. However, there were a couple of cases in the courts where the courts realized that there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
One was, I'm trying to think if it was either Brandeis or Amherst, where the young man was passed out. The woman who was his girlfriend's roommate gave him a oral sex, and then realized that maybe that wasn't a good idea, texted a friend that very night to say, well, hopefully he's drunk enough he won't remember, right? And then months later ends up filing a claim against him, and the school finds him responsible. And thank God that student had the money to go to court,
right?
Because you're entitled to discovery, and her texts were discovered.
Right.
So, you know, if he had not had that money, he would have been Amherst. He would have been totally, his life would have been over, and that's what happens to these kids. They can't get into another college. And even if they do get into another college, it's not usually a college as good as the one they were ejected from. And this whole taint follows them their entire life. We've had kids lose jobs over this. And it's not even criminal in most cases, at least most cases that we've seen. It does not involve criminal conduct.
So the criminal conduct is not even alleged? Or you just don't think that the conduct that was...
Usually what's alleged is non-consensual intercourse or non-consensual sex.
Well, wouldn't that be
but
sexual assault?
The facts, when they don't rise to that level, most of the time it's consent being invalidated because they were intoxicated,
okay,
or because you're supposed to ask before you move on to the next section of the person's body. So affirmative consent.
Right.
Almost every case we have did not involve criminal conduct. And we've had up to 1,500 cases. I mean, there are some that alleged it.
1,500 cases.
Yes, of students coming to us based on unfair proceedings.
Okay, so let's talk about Title IX, because we've been talking a little bit in generalities, but what is it and what are the problems with it? And then maybe we can talk about what changes Betsy DeVos is proposing.
Well, Title IX itself is very broad. It basically says you can't discriminate against somebody to the point where it interferes with their access to education.
Okay.
I mean, that's all it says. So under Title IX, there are regulations, but up till now, the regulations haven't been specific. However, the court did interpret that eventually. First, they interpreted it as applying to situations that are known as quid pro quo. For instance, where a person of power has, gotten somebody to do something in a coercive manner mm-hmm. based on their position of power, which, of course, would be professors and students, and that makes perfect sense. However, eventually it became broadened to apply to student-on-student misconduct, sexual misconduct. And I think that was, somehow influenced by this ideology of the patriarchy and men having the power and control in relationships. But in any event, that's what happened. It broadened to that. So it's been the courts and pressure on the Department of Education to expand the interpretation of Title IX to include these issues. The Obama administration issued guidance that tried to cement this interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not Title IX itself, it's
right.
more the interpretation of it. So because of what the Obama administration did, a lot of schools started erring on the side of finding students guilty. And in fact, as you mentioned earlier, most of these cases are very gray. And yet, victims' advocates, have this attitude that if a student is found not responsible, that's the equivalent of calling a complainant a liar, which is problematic, because it could be viewed as a threshold, not a zero-sum game. But that pressured schools further to make a choice. Now, when you take away the option of saying, I don't know, in cases where that's a likely response, what do? Well, you've got pressure here from the Department of Education, so then you start finding students guilty when there's some kind of a, I don't really know the answer case.
Right,
so,
right. I also think there's pressure from the public or from student groups
yes.
that if a man accused of sexual assault on campus is... if they decide there's not enough evidence to investigate or they investigate and find him not responsible, that can cause demonstrations and things like that you're not taking sexual
yes,
assault seriously enough.
Significant pressure from student body. And Yale is a perfect example of that. They have a student that they expelled that had, somebody start a petition and ended up with 75,000 signatures not to let him back on campus, despite the fact that he was found innocent in a criminal case on all counts within 3 or 4 hours, and the jury came out and said she wasn't credible, and all the evidence supported his position. And yet, the campus still found him guilty after that.
I understand that. I mean, I don't think people have enough respect for the judicial system when it works, or for any kind of a process when it works. There's the sometimes the decision is made that somebody is guilty before there's been any investigation based on pretty
yep.
skimpy evidence, and then that's still solidified even after a court finds them not guilty.
I've seen investigative reports that from the very moment the report was taken on the first day the complaint was made refer to the parties as victims and perpetrators, and also assume that a sexual assault had taken place. Assume. And that happens all the time. Because we have this believe the victim mantra that I know you're familiar with.
Yes.
That demands that everybody that comes forward be believed. Now, that makes sense if you're counseling somebody or even interviewing, it's shown that, you know, that certain methods have more success in eliciting the facts. But unfortunately, this is now being taught, at least in the United States, to, you know, even criminal investigators and prosecutors believe the victim, which is completely inappropriate and violates every ethical code for objectivity that I can even think of.
Well, I think it's true in the past that oftentimes women who made accusations of sexual assault were dismissed because they were considered to be promiscuous, or they were wearing revealing clothing, or there were many reasons not to ever investigate. But I think going to the other extreme of saying, okay, we have a victim here, we're going to assume that it's true, goes into pretty problematical areas.
I agree with you that there was a problem. I mean, obviously there was a problem. I don't think very many people would object with that. But the issue is today, and you can't adjudicate a case against a specific student based on likelihoods or what happened in the past. You have to take the facts of that case.
Right.
I think
we end up if we believe the victim, I don't think that it's correct to say that historically sexual assault was never taken seriously. For example, when a black man was accused of sexually assaulting a white woman, that was always taken extremely seriously, even if it was just a rumor. And that's where we end up, I think, if we assume that the victim is correct. Thinking of the case of Emmett Till, who was accused of some sexual misconduct many years ago and was lynched. I know there's not been lynchings on campus because of sexual assault, but that's sort of the direction that you head in if you demonize everybody who's ever accused of something.
Right, and there is, you know, some people believe that there's a racial component. We have had black students, and rather than racial, to me it seems more to be socioeconomic, but there could also be a racial component because these students, of lower socioeconomic status can't afford lawyers. And once you get the lawyer in there to oversee what the school is doing, they're going to be a lot more careful. But the other issue, and a black mother, when we were talking about her son having gone through this, and it was horrible, what they did to this poor young kid who liked Superman or Star Wars or something, she said to me, you know, you don't realize this is just more of the same for us. And that really struck me, and it stuck with me, because it's just tragic, really.
Yes.
That it ever was that, and now that it's spread.
Yes, and I think the socioeconomic aspect is real, because these cases can be extraordinarily time-consuming and expensive. And I think most people in America and other countries couldn't afford a process that takes 2 years and involves a considerable amount of lawyers' hours.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's our biggest problem, is the lack of resources to pay for attorneys. And, you know, our families do try to support each other and give them advice based on their experiences, but that can only go so far.
A couple of characteristics of some of the investigations, not all of them. One of them is that there is a single investigator in a non-adversarial proceeding who makes the decision about whether misconduct happened or not. And the second is that there's generally no possibility for cross-examination of the accuser. So can you address the problems with those two issues?
Yes, those are two big issues. Both equally problematic, I think. The single investigator has always been a problem because, of course, there's confirmation bias. You do the investigation, you assume you're right, and the student is guilty. The other problem with the single investigator is that there is no opportunity for cross-examination. The way they've handled it in the past is the investigator will interview each party separately. Mm-hmm. They may give each party the opportunity to hand the investigator questions to ask of the other party, but there's no guarantee the investigator will ask them. You have no idea in what manner it's asked. You know, is it leading? Who knows? And there's no opportunity for follow-up questions. And follow-up questions are often how you show inconsistencies or, you know, possibly falsities or even, you know, impaired memory.
Right.
So that's a huge problem. So it kind of interacts with the cross-examination, which, of course, you understand is necessary because you've got to watch when somebody answers questions. You can't just trust that the investigator, who's probably biased anyway, is going to come back and tell you, well, yes, he squirmed when I asked him this question. That's just not going to happen.
I think a lot of people have a hard time understanding why a woman, and I understand that not all of these cases are a woman accusing a man, but the vast majority, have difficulty understanding why a woman would falsely accuse a man. It seems like it must be something very rare, that the woman must be horrible. I remember reading a couple of cases where the initiating factor was stuff like embarrassment. Somebody discovered that you had sex with somebody else, and you wanted to get out of the embarrassment of maybe having chosen to have sex with somebody that you later decided you shouldn't have had to with. Another was, you know, trying to make another boy jealous by having a relationship with another boy, something like that. So there seems to be lots of different reasons for these accusations, other than just a young woman just wants to destroy somebody's life. I mean, what have you observed in terms of, I mean, can you sort of figure out what the motivation was for an accusation that was false or was overly strong?
Exaggerate, right. The two examples you give, we see repeatedly. And often the first example, somebody discovers they've had sex, can be a Christian, Mormon, or Muslim parent. And we've all had all of that.
Mm.
Discovers their daughter had sex. And so there has to be an excuse.
Mm-hmm.
The boyfriend discovers it. The second example, which you gave, was to make somebody jealous. Yes, we've seen that as well. We've also seen where, you know, there's a hookup, and one party does not want to continue a relationship, but the other party does. Normally, the female does. I don't know. Sometimes women seem to have more hope than is justified in that regard. But, you know, and then there's anger,
right,
and retribution. We also see, you know, the complainant is failing a class. And, well, you know, this happened, as an excuse, not realizing that it's going to get blown into a huge matter. And I always refer to it as the freight train leaving the station. Or, you know, her friends are telling her, well, you didn't sleep with that guy, did you? Or, you know, some. But the other thing,
right,
that happens is that we have a lot of situations in which somebody's blacked out or claims to be blacked out. You never know for sure, right?
Right.
But the problem with that is that, you know, science tells us that blacked out individuals can act normally, and the other person has no way of knowing they're blacked out. It's just a matter of their brain not making memories. So, but the schools don't seem to care, and if, you know, they consented while they were blacked out and don't remember it, it's a rape. So that's a problem.
I mean, I think the problem is that there are gray areas. I mean, between the, for example, with alcohol, between the single drink and being completely unconscious, there's, you know, there's not a bright line where you can say, okay, at this point, this man or woman can no longer make a rational decision. And even if there was, it would be very difficult for their partner to say, okay, on the third drink, it was okay, but now on the fourth drink, you know, I shouldn't pursue sex because she's clearly not able to make a good decision.
But blacking out is a different animal,
mm-hmm,
altogether, because that you're not incapacitated. I mean, you don't appear incapacitated. You're not passed out. You're functioning. You can drive a car.
I interpret blacking out as being unconscious. But you're saying it's just lost memory of what happened the night before.
No, read the science on this. It's really interesting. I didn't know at first either, but there's a certain portion of your brain, and it usually happens, you know, like this pre-gaming I mentioned earlier, taking several shots in quick succession.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're physically fine, and you're walking around having conversations, but some trigger in your brain just turns off the memory recording. But you can drive cars. You can consent. You can do all of those things. But the problem is that schools don't seem to understand that and assume, like you do, and like I did before, that it, you know, it means that they're somehow incapacitated, but that's not the case.
Okay. Yes, I definitely am not up to speed with that. That's never happened to me, although I forget things all the time, but I can't blame I can't blame anything
on it. Me neither.
Can you describe a couple of cases that illustrate, anecdotally illustrate what's happened to some of these young men and some of the problems in those cases?
Well, in a lot of our cases, the first step in the process is the school calls the student in. And on many occasions, and I don't know percentages, but many occasions, they have no idea why they're being called in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem, because it's as though they're being trapped. You know, somebody wants to trap them. They don't want to be honest and forthright and aren't really looking for the truth. They're looking for a way to find the student guilty. So notice is huge. And
so, can I just address that? So normally, like in a court situation,
yeah.
you will receive a complaint, and it'll say you're being sued, you've been charged with this, and you'll be given some information about it so that when you go to court and have to defend yourself, you can prepare yourself. But in this case, you're called in, and you're going to be going into a meeting to discuss this this accusation of sexual impropriety, and you didn't even know that there was a concern before you walked in the door.
Exactly. Sometimes you might know it's sexual misconduct, but you might not know who or when.
Mm-hmm.
It's really problematic, and a lot. And the courts have consistently said that that's not okay.
I mean,
we really have to give notice. And the new regulations would require details, and you know, details like who, what, when, where, and just basic details, right?
Right.
So that's. That is a huge problem. Another problem is that they aren't given the right to have somebody with them. And, you know, these are young kids. And often the school is represented by their own counsel or experienced administrators. And so it's almost like David versus Goliath. You know, this
right.
kid that comes in and has no idea that this is serious.
And yet the accuser is usually provided with some kind of support.
Well, the school, of course. And plus, the school represents the accuser's position. So it's like the accused is being prosecuted. We've had kids, you know, and it's a natural inclination as a young adult. You think, well, okay, I'm an adult. I need to handle this, right? And plus, you believe that if you do the right thing, you'll be fine. Tell the truth. You'll be fine. So you go into this meeting and you do whatever, you find out, you know, no, that wasn't okay. Maybe you even go through the whole process before you call your parents. The first time some parents get notices from an emergency room or a hospital where the kid has tried suicide. I mean, that's how devastating this is. So, you know, that's a problem. Students need to have an advocate. And giving somebody an advocate who's employed by the school isn't very helpful, because they just run back and tell the school whatever it is you've told them. Okay, so the next problem is they don't give you access to evidence. And again, some schools are doing it right, but other schools aren't. But some schools will say, no, you can't have that because of privacy concerns or whatever. Or they'll call you into their office and say, you have an hour to go through this, like, 1,000-page file, but you can't take pictures, you can't take notes, or maybe you can take notes, but only handwritten notes. And it restricts your ability to understand the complete collection of evidence, you know, what's there. Plus, often you're not told of any evidence that may exonerate you. You're only shown the evidence they're going to use against you. So that's a problem.
Right. So if there were witness statements and some people said, you know, it looked like it was a consensual encounter and other people said not, you might only see the statements from those who said it didn't look consensual?
Possibly. Yes. That has happened.
Yeah. Would you know who the witnesses are?
Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you do. It depends. I had a case where they didn't allow the student to see anything, including the complainant statement, till like 24 hours before the hearing, and wouldn't let him see any witness statements. So they did show it to him briefly during the hearing, which, you know, that's not doesn't facilitate somebody's ability to defend themselves, obviously.
No, I mean, when you're in a hearing, you've got adrenaline going, right? Your life is on the line. How can you possibly sit down and analyze stuff, even if you have the time?
Right. No, these are kids.
Yeah.
There was one court that said, you know, this is an 18-year-old kid. How can you expect them to know how to defend themselves in these cases? And the school will say, well, it's just educational. This is an educational process. And there have been at least one or two courts that have said, yeah, that's not right. That is not credible, because it's clearly adversarial, and the school makes it adversarial, unfortunately, because I think a lot of these cases would be better handled through some kind of an informal resolution process, which, of course, the new regulations allow, and the previous administration did not.
I was going to ask you about restorative justice, which is a process where both parties kind of sit down. And it encourages people to admit they made mistakes, because you don't have the consequences of, if I admit anything in an adversarial position, then I'm going to be thrown out of school and, like you say, may never get into another school, so my life's dreams are destroyed. Whereas maybe in a restorative justice process, both parties could say, you know, I made mistakes. I should have found out whether you really had a romantic interest in me before I slept with you. I shouldn't have assumed that because we slept together that a relationship would develop, something like that. I mean, there could be a lot of things that could come out when the parties are in a situation where they can share without the severe consequences.
Right. And sometimes there's no fault. I mean, sometimes it isn't a false allegation, and sometimes you know, it's neither. It's neither an assault nor a false allegation. It's two people's different interpretations of what happened. I think that happens all the time.
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I mean, especially with young people who are not sexually experienced. They are not experienced with maintaining limits when they take drugs and alcohol so that they can get themselves into situations where they don't really want to be. Okay, so continue through this process. Are there other issues in this sort of illustrative process?
Well, obviously
process?
the lack of ability to cross-examine or even question the other party. You know, the whole submit your questions in writing garbage is terrible, because the school will ask maybe some of them or maybe none of them. And even if they ask them, they won't ask follow-up questions in many cases. It's just, you know, it's useless. And if that's the way to determine credibility, which is the issue on which most of these cases turn, then you've completely negated a student's ability to defend themselves.
Right.
You know, and then, of course, at the same time, we have the interplay of these victim-centered trauma-informed theories, which say that, well, you know, that text that she sent, you know, a week later telling you how much she loved her was just a result of the trauma she suffered, and so not relevant to this case.
Really?
You know, that's not okay. Because
no.
That basically obliterates any ability to defend yourself.
Right. If everything... I think also it infantilizes women, don't you think?
Oh. Clearly,
if what I write as a woman as in a text message cannot be taken seriously, then how can you take me seriously as a person?
I actually find it embarrassing. It's almost embarrassing to me, having grown up in the 70s and gone to college in the 70s, when you know, it was all about women's liberation and we're powerful, we can do what we want. And, you know, and I did, and I became a lawyer, and I feel pretty proud that, you know, I stuck it out even though I didn't have a lot of resources. But now it's like they want to say, well, you know, everything's an excuse, and they want to be victims, and I just don't understand that. I really don't.
Yes. So let's talk about what Betsy DeVos is proposing to change in this process. And I think there's been some changes in what she proposed. But what are some of the major changes that she's proposing? And do you agree with them all, or are some of them still problematic?
I agree pretty much with all of them. I think, you know, of course, single investigator has to go. Cross-examination is crucial. I think it's appropriate that the cross-examination does not have to be done by the parties themselves, because, frankly, I think that would be a problem for both parties. I don't really give much credence to the objection that somehow the advisors are going to traumatize the other party by aggressive questioning, because, you know, we've had lawyers involved in these cases now for years, and I've never heard of that happening. I've never heard of a lawyer aggressively doing anything, and I'm not doubting it happens, but it's not common. And it also presumes that the school has no control, and I don't think that's the case.
Well, let's talk about that. What are the reasons for not cross-examining? Let's assume that this person is a victim of sexual assault. One of the reasons is that it's traumatizing, and that in the past, sometimes the cross-examination has been trying to paint the woman as promiscuous, therefore, if this guy had sex with her, what's the big deal? But there are limits on that, right?
Right, there are limits.
Lawyer
can't.
Lots
of laws now about.
Pardon
yeah,
me?
Bring up. Yeah, no, there's definitely other rape shield laws. There's laws that preclude you bringing up certain things, which are appropriate, I think. And this is in a criminal case anyway. This is, you know, administrators in a room with two parties, and maybe in separate rooms even, which is also appropriate. So,
but I mean, similar protections are necessary, right? I mean, you can't have lawyers just dragging up pre-campus sexual experiences that seem to have no relevance except to paint the woman as promiscuous.
That's covered by the rules. Mm-hmm. That is included in the proposed rules that they can't do that. And just the plain aggressive prosecutor type or whatever, that is, you know, like I said, the school has control to basically kick the person out of there.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to lay down and watch that happen. You know, there is some truth to the fact that it will make it a little more difficult for complaints to come forward. I agree with that. But justice isn't easy, right? And it shouldn't be easy. And in the past, it's been easy. We've heard young women refer to this as a tool. Oh, if I want to get rid of Johnny, all I have to do is Title IX him. File that form. That's all I have to do. So, yeah, that's not okay. And I think these rules are trying to bring a balance. They're not trying to harm victims. They're trying to support victims. But they also want to be sure that the decisions are accurate. And accurate decisions are better for all parties, because the system is more reliable. I have spoken with two criminal victims of criminal sexual assault, who said they don't like this because it undermines what they've been through.
Right.
So yes, you'll have to answer questions about your allegations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's reasonable.
A couple of things that I wonder are involved. People at universities are generally probably a higher socioeconomic class than average, and for parents who've, you know, carefully nurtured their children up to the age of university, this is like the first time that they've been unsupervised, and there's probably a lot of fear, especially with the parents of daughters, that, you know, things are going to start happening at school. My daughter's going to drink, she's going to start having sex. Do you think that fear sort of people of a higher socioeconomic class has encouraged this?
I don't know if it's the parents. What I do wonder, however, since a lot of these seem to coalesce the problematic cases in some of the more elite institutions, mm-hmm. if there's just not an entitlement attitude, and maybe, you know, they don't have to worry about feeding themselves or whatever, you know, so here they have the freedom to start obsessing about issues that really shouldn't be as blown out of proportion as they are. Now, that doesn't say it doesn't happen. I would never say that, because I know it does. But these cases where they're gray, and those situations that we mentioned earlier that repeat themselves, sometimes I wonder.
I worry that a school is going to look at their list, you know, 10 accusations of sexual assault or sexual impropriety were made, and 8 no fault found. Do they worry that a record like that is going to cause the Department of Education to crack down on them? So it had better be more like 8 found guilty and 2 no fault found?
Under the previous administration, they were right to worry about that, because the previous administration relied on those statistics that said 4 or 5 out of 100 or whatever, or 20%, 25% out of 100 are raped on campus. And when the schools, and I don't think any schools ever reached that percentage, but when the schools, you know, numbers weren't that high, we had legislators and others say, well, that's because they're still not, you know, reporting, or they're still not, you know, following up on these accusations. And I don't believe that's true. I think that schools truly tried very hard under the previous administration to do the right thing. They just erred on the side of, you know, being more skeptical of the respondents.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to change. You know, and part of the reason that's not going to change is because of what you mentioned earlier, and that is the pressure on campus. They're not going to allow that to change, right?
And also, I think we have to admit that a lot of sexual assaults are going to go unpunished even when they happen, because they occur in private, so that you might have suspicions that what happened was non-consensual, but if there were no witnesses, which is probably less common on campuses, but is certainly common with most sexual relations occur in private, and it boils down to 2 people's statements. I mean, in those cases, the chances are that in a fair process, the accused person would get off more, just because there's no absolute proof that the accuser was correct. There's no witnesses. There's no physical evidence.
And that's exactly why cross-examination in some form is crucial. Exactly. Because, you know, you've heard stories about people, and then you may have had the occasion to meet with whatever person the story was about and have them tell you what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you feel more able to determine the truth if you've actually hearing the person tell their own story?
Well, yes. I mean, I know myself, if I was to take a story from somebody and then tell it, it would be colored by my perception, and I might fill in the things that I didn't know, because I would assume that certain things happened or not. And I have had experience, not in any serious way, where I've said something and then later found out, well, I just assumed that was the case, it actually wasn't. And that would be a really big deal in some kind of quasi-legal tribunal.
Right.
We talked a little bit about the consequences for young men who are found guilty. You know, maybe that's not quite the right word, because it's still not a fully legal process. But when a man is sanctioned because of a university process, can you describe some of the consequences and address the issue that it's not really that serious because they're not going to go to jail, so what's the big deal if a few men get falsely sanctioned for false accusations?
Well, you know, you have to remember that, well, first of all, you know, there's the reputational damage and the career damage, but even aside from that, these are people who worked very hard to go to college, you know, who've worked their whole life focus on how they're going to do in college and what college they'll attend. And since a lot of these occur at elite schools, you know, there's more effort put into these students. So based on their belief system, which has been told to them since they were a child, that America has this great judicial system, do the right thing, tell the truth, you'll be fine, they have a very strong sense of justice. And when you're found responsible for something you didn't do, it's not just upsetting. It's devastating. It's almost as though your entire belief system collapses. And more importantly, you realize there's nothing you could do to protect yourself. Nothing. Because stuff happens. And for a young person, that's a very hard lesson. And then the repercussions are so horrible because, you know, like I said, there have been suicides. Yes, there have been suicides. There have been a lot of attempts. Almost every student, not every, but almost every student says they contemplated suicide. Mm. So, you know, the stories I've heard are horrendous. And it affects the whole family. There have been suicides of other family members based on this. So mm-hmm. When you've envisioned this life, you've worked so hard, you lose it through no fault of your own, you can't graduate from the school you've dreamed of or, you know, whatever. You can't have a job like the job you wanted because of this. It's very hard to adapt, especially at that age.
We talked about socioeconomic factors before. A lot of poorer students in the United States get to good colleges on scholarships, especially athletic scholarships. I assume that if you're sanctioned, you obviously lose that scholarship. And even if you could get into another institution, you're not going to have the money, because you were relying on the scholarship money.
There have been a few cases where they have gotten another scholarship at a different school, especially, you know, based on some of these fact mm-hmm. patterns. But often, no, you lose your scholarship. You also owe back loans that you've taken out that you can never show a degree for.
Right.
We've had families have to sell their homes. I mean, it's horrible, and it's not right.
Yes, I hadn't thought about that particular issue, but I mean, student debt in the United States is a huge issue of its own, and if you're halfway through, I mean, let's say you're in third year of a four-year degree, you've spent all that money and now you're kicked out, but you still have the loans, but you don't have the degree that's going to help you pay back the loans.
Right.
Well, we're coming towards...
Huh?
Sorry?
Wow, huh? It's pretty sad.
Yes. There's lots of things I hadn't thought about. We're coming towards the end of our time. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up that we haven't discussed so far today?
I think we've done a pretty good job of covering everything. You know, back to the proposed regulations, I think that, you know, I met with Betsy DeVos with our students, and I really believe she's trying to do the right thing. And understandably, because she's a Trump appointee, everybody wants to dump on her. But she's a very intense woman and trying very hard to do the right thing here. I think people are unfair to her, you know, in assuming that somehow she's trying to take away victim protections. I don't think anybody wants that. I don't even want that. No, I mean, that's not anything that FACE advocates for. What we want is a balanced process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for instance, if the school really wants to find the truth, why would they hide the evidence? Why would they not give notice?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so, to me, those things are just things you do when you want a fair process.
Regarding Betsy DeVos, politically, I'm not very aligned with her, and I think her actions on things like student loans are terrible, but I think it's a real mistake in politics to assume that because, you know, somebody is politically aligned, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum, that therefore everything they do or say is wrong. And it's sad that politics has kind of got to this point. I mean, with Donald Trump, I'm a great believer that there should be peace between North and South Korea. Like, why would you criticize him for that? Just because you hate Donald Trump, right? So
you're right. They group everything together, and they are not discerning about the issues, which doesn't make any sense. I mean, there are some things he's done that are good. The economy's doing better. Oh, but no, that, you know, that's the previous administration. That's why the economy's doing better.
Yeah,
but
right.
But on the other hand, of course, he does stupid things.
Yes.
Because, you know, he's dumb.
yeah, I... So I think we need to look at these regulations of Betsy DeVos clearly and not just color them with she's a horrible person, if that's what you think, therefore she can't do anything right. Because I think in this case it's clearly for the interests of justice to change the regulations.
I do want to mention that there was an op-ed in the New York Times a couple weeks back by Dana Bolger, who is a victim's advocate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she discussed the regulations. But what really struck me were the over 300-something comments, probably 90% of which were supporting the regulations. And that shocked me, especially because the New York Times tends to have a liberal audience, a very liberal audience,
right,
who does
right.
not like DeVos. But the interesting thing was even those people who said, I don't like DeVos, think she's terrible, but on this she's right. And there were many of those comments. It was interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I think people can see that this has gone, the pendulum swung too far in the opposite direction, and what Betsy DeVos is proposing is an improvement.
The problem for us, though, is that there'll never be as many of us as there are victims and victim advocates, or students who believe in the... So they're holding all these comment writing parties and, you know, whatever, and a lot of the comments are the same, which will probably be ignored, but some of them, you know, basically say nothing of substance. They're, you know, you shouldn't change these rules because it'll be unfair to survivors, and then that's it.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm hoping that the quality of the comments that are the people that understand what we're doing, you know, will prevail over the quantity of the comments submitted by the other side. But I did actually, I have drafted instructions and put them online just so people know if they want to make a comment how to do it.
Oh, okay. Well, I would encourage people to do that if they have an opinion one way or the other. And I would...
Yes, and that's on our website. So
okay.
They could just go to, I think it's Face, is it? I don't know. Probably they have to get into the quality.
Verify your website, and I will put it in the show notes so that people can get to your organization if they need to. Okay.
Or our Facebook page.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you, Cynthia, very much for joining me today. It's been very informative.
Yes. Thank you for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to provide some balance on this issue.
Okay, great. Have a great day. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to episode 206 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for future guests, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.